Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
A multiple Tony, Emmy, Obie, and Drama Desk Award winner, Swoosie Kurtz is a Broadway icon whose work also includes movies like Liar Liar, Dangerous Liaisons, Citizen Ruth, and the television hits Sisters, Pushing Daisies, and of course, Mike and Molly. She is the author of the brand new Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. It's a great pleasure to welcome Swoosie Kurtz to the Roundtable. Thank you so much.
Joe, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
A delight to have you with us. This is radio, so I will do my best to explain. But there's a beautiful picture of you with your mother and father in front of the plane that your father flew, Swoos.
Yes, the B-17 that he flew in the war. That's what I was named after, the Swoos. And it was in the Smithsonian for quite a few years, getting ready to be restored. But that costs millions of dollars, so that never happened. But the Air Force Museum is now restoring it.
That says a lot about what you meant to him, what that plane, what that experience meant to him, to name your child after that part of your life.
Yes, I've often wondered that these two adult people actually thought this was a legitimate name for a child. But I've had to live with it all these years. But now I love it. I've accepted it now, and I embrace it.
What point did you come to embrace it?
Probably, I think in my 40s, I really owned it then. I stopped fighting it. But as a kid, you know, my dad was in the Air Force and we moved around constantly. So I was always in a new school. And you know, when you're a kid, you just want to blend in. You want to be Mary or Jane, or I did anyway. And you don't want to sort of stand out and be different. But in showbiz, it's good to stand out and be different.
Your father not only was a pilot during the war, also an Olympic diver, an amazing background.
I know. And he was an Olympic diver from the high platform, you know, the one with no bounce. So the man was obviously not afraid of heights. And he soared in every way, a real overachiever.
And your mother wrote a book about her experiences and your father's experiences.
Exactly. She wrote a book when she was pregnant with me that was published in 1945, My Rival, the Sky. And it was about her courtship with my dad, their love affair, being engaged for 6 years or something crazy like that, and then getting married, trying to have a child. And the book ends with my birth. And it's a dream come true for me that not only did my book come out, but also her book is being re-released with an introduction by me as an ebook. So I'm just thrilled about that.
What is it like to have that document, to know that this is what your mother was telling? This was published by Putnam.
Exactly.
In the time. So this was being told to the world of your early story.
It's amazing to have that history of your parents. I mean, who really has that? You know, some people have some ancestral stories, but to have it documented like this from my mother's home front point of view while he was away at war. And I reread her book. I'd read it many times, but I reread it when we went to war with Iraq. And it was astonishing how it hit me. I felt like, except for Skyping and texting and, you know, video hookup and all of that, this could have been written yesterday afternoon. Because people don't change. And when you have a loved one in harm's way, away at war, it's the same human feelings. And she covers that so beautifully in the book of making friends with loneliness. And, you know, then, because they didn't have this kind of communication we have now, she never knew for months at a time whether he was missing, prisoner of war, dead. You know, they would try to get a special delivery letter through to each other, and that could take 3 weeks or 6 weeks, and then it would all be blocked out by the censors.
You beautifully weave parts of her book into your story. And this is very much a story about you, but also about your parents and your relationship with them.
Exactly. I try to sort of chronicle their lives through my life. And my mother and I especially, I love it when they're, you know, I put an excerpt from her book when she was a certain age, and then my chapter begins with me at that age. Mm. And these two women, my mother and me, made very, very different life choices, but both totally valid for who we are. And they both worked beautifully for us. They were very, very different, though.
And it seemed that if you mirror one parent more than the other, it would have been your father then.
I think so. I'm so much like both of them that I know for sure I wasn't adopted. But I have my father's drive and singleness of purpose and discipline and focus. My mother has more of a gift for people. Her people skills are much better than my father's and mine were. She will stop and smell every rose. Mm. And we're sort of striding ahead. And people say, you know, would always say to me, where's the fire?
Your father would even play a role in, not so much a role, but would have advice for you in a career. I mean, he would be able to look at a show and say, oh, well, this one may last five, this will go 5 years.
Exactly. When we first started with Sisters on NBC, you know, we got picked up, just barely got picked up for four episodes and got picked up in dribs and drabs. Like, here's another six episodes. And he said, right after we did the pilot, he said, 5 years. I went, oh, you know, we'll see, skeptically, because I've been around showbiz so long. I thought, no. You know. And he was always a cockeyed optimist, both my parents. Very upbeat, very enthusiastic. And he kept saying 5 years, and one by one, we were picked up for five seasons, actually almost 6 years.
You have been the caretaker for your mother for the past seven years, and your mother is 98, and that is a very conscious decision, isn't it, to say, I am going to take this on?
Well, it happened so gradually that I didn't see it coming. I didn't know it was coming. It was something I never thought about. But it gradually grew to be that. And my mom and I have always been joined at the heart. Just this bond between us is so strong that it just evolved. That she would come and live with me when everything was fine. This just continued as she started to change and grow older and decline in some ways. And it's been, I have to say, the greatest gift I've ever had. Parenting your own parent is, I think, one of the full circle gifts of life. It's a great blessing and hugely challenging. I'm very, very blessed and fortunate to be able to have the resources to have caregivers. So, you know, someone is always with her when I go off to work. But nonetheless, I'm there with her 24/7, you know, emotionally or physically or both. And it's challenging.
Rosalind Carter once told me that she had done a lot of work on long-term care and said that her feeling is that most people who do it because they want to, and because at the end they feel that they couldn't imagine anyone else doing it.
Oh, exactly. It's not even like a choice. There's sometimes, I think, with anyone who does this, there's two battling voices inside. One that can, because we're human, start to resent or become angry about the accommodations and the sacrifices. But then the stronger voice is the one that simply couldn't walk away. And that's the one that I hear the most. But, you know, I never had children, which I never sought having children. It's not something I wanted to do. But I think that this is the universe's way of saying You're not getting out that easy. I've got my 98-and-a-half-year-old toddler.
and there's that care. And I, along with my brother and wife, cared for my father in his last several years. And although he did not, unlike your mother, did not suffer with dementia. And that's a different ball game, isn't it? Because it isn't the person that you had that close relationship with. It really is a change and a journey and a difference.
It's very much a very specialized journey. I mean, my mom, Margot, as I've always called her, is still very much present every few moments or so. But she does this classic thing that I think with dementia they do, is I've got to go home. I've got to go home. And it's so poetic in a way, because I don't know if she means heaven or home in her heart, or she just wants to get someplace else where she will be like she used to be. And she thinks if she gets out of this house, everything will be fine. But it becomes really obsessive, and you don't know quite what to do. So the caregivers and I have formed this sort of theater domestica where we all play these parts and we become absolute master improvisers. You know, I play all kinds of parts. I play Swoosie, you know, cast as type, and I play a handsome gentleman caller, non-traditional casting, and various extras. And because at a certain point, it became clear to all of us that the reality check was not the way to go. When she would ask about my dad, you know, she'd say, "Where's Frankie? He died in 1996. I used to say, "Mommy, you know, Frankie died a few years ago." And that would be okay for a while, but at a certain point, we turned a corner, and it's much better to say, "Darling, Frankie's at the Pentagon on a mission." And she goes, oh, and she's totally satisfied. And she'll think that her parents are arriving tonight. And we just say, "Oh, Gigi and Daddy Art are in Omaha." And she says, oh, right.
And then sometimes she'll say, and correct you and say, "No, he has passed."
That's the great thing is, yes, she's so sharp still in so many ways. We had a big conversation one night about, I said, "Oh, he's at the Pentagon. You know, Frankie's at the Pentagon and he's on a mission for the government." And we went back and forth about it. And then she goes, "What Frank are you talking about? My Frank's dead." I went, "Oh, wow, she's in there. She knows exactly what's going on."
Seeing those glimpses, does it make it tougher?
It does. It does, because I am seduced back into that soft land, my original comfort zone, and the illusion that it will be there forever. You know, it's the long goodbye. But as she says in her book, my dad and she never said goodbye. They only said goodnight.
Mm.
And I think that she will always be with me. Always.
You have a great line in the book that even though you come from this great family, you're an only child, you had wonderful parents, and yet you say, you make the point that you have a therapist and say that, you know, even if you're going to be in Hollywood, you almost have to have a therapist.
Yes.
That's a standard issue.
Right, right.
Because there's always the things that you have to work out.
Well, you know, everybody should have a therapist. I'm lucky to be able to have one. You know, you have to be crazy to begin with to be in show business. So that's established already that I'm crazy. And she is so insightful. She's read Margot's book years ago, and she knows Margot. And she never met my dad, but she will come out with these startling bits of insight. One time she said to me, "Well, it seems like the only thing missing from your childhood was a child." And I went, "Oh, my God." Because we were like three adults together. I was always treated as an adult. And my opinion was always valued. And my preferences were always valued. I always felt heard and listened to. Not in a precocious or precious way. Just like, yeah, I was worth, you know, my opinion counted for something. I think because we moved around so much, I would try to make friends, but then I was plucked out of one place and we traveled to another place and plunked down into a new group of people, which incidentally was the best training in the world for this life I have now,
right,
which has absolutely no continuity in terms of the work. But I think I was probably thrown back on my parents much more because of this, you know, kind of difficulty of making friends for any amount of time. So we just were the three of us together, our merry band of three.
Do you believe that it has an effect on you as an actor because it gives you a confidence?
I think it definitely does. I think I was thrown back on my imagination to create, to entertain myself, because I, also being an only child and also being kind of this nomadic life with them, and I didn't have tons of playmates or sisters and brothers around me all the time, so I would make up things. I remember playing Monopoly and all by myself, but I'd set out the board and I'd have three other imaginary friends there, you know, and one was, I got to watch out for this guy. He'll hide the money under the table and he's a real cheat, you know, and somebody else would be like really dumb about money and not be able to add it up. So I would make up these different personalities. Of course, I would play them all. And then there was me, which was never as interesting as those other colorful characters. I just wanted to be somebody else.
And not being overly psychological, but even in the book, it seems as though you paint your parents as much more interesting, perhaps, than yourself.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, because I didn't really want my story. You know, that was not my passion, to tell my story. I really wanted to tell about them.
Mm.
But the book, you know, contains my whole life and my whole career.
I was surprised. I didn't realize that you were just 17 when you first were on television with Donna Reed.
Was I 17? Oh, yeah. But then there were all those years of unemployment after that before I actually got my first grown-up job.
And at what point did you know that you wanted it to be your job?
When I was in high school. I wanted to be a prima ballerina before that. But in high school, I was in this amazing acting class at Hollywood High, believe it or not, with this man called John Engel, who was a legendary drama teacher there. And he really lit the fire for me. I did a scene in class and I had that eureka in the bathtub moment where I became someone else and I connected with the audience, with the class, you know, so much, with so much more clarity and excitement than I could ever relate one-on-one in life.
I became familiar with your work through Love, Sydney.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a fascinating, reading back on it and reading about it now is even more fascinating than because I had forgotten
right.
The uproar of the time of a gay character on television.
I know.
You, Tony Randall.
And My Little Girl.
Yes.
Yeah, how crazy is that? That we forget, you know, with the freedom we have now on television and film. It's hard to believe. It was the early 80s, and it was the first show that ever had a gay character on it. It was on NBC, and Tony was adamant that we maintain that the character's gay, you know, and he really fought the good fight. But the affiliates started pulling out before they had ever even seen anything. They just heard about it. And it was tough, but we went on for two seasons. And it was a really good show.
It was a good show. Although it was sort of de-gayed at some point.
It was de-gayed, and he just became a happy bachelor.
Do you look for, it seems now with your family on Mike and Molly, you write about it at the beginning of this book, that is that what you ultimately strive for, is to find those situations where you can set for a while and be in a good environment?
You mean in terms of a job?
Yes.
Well, you know, I didn't plan it. It's not something I strived for. I think as an actor, you just, it's kind of pathetic, but you sort of just take what comes your way. Your only real power as an actor is to say no. And the choices that you make, you know, determine your career. And I just feel I didn't really have that much choice in the matter. I was so lucky, so blessed, the things that have dropped into my lap, and Mike and Molly being the most current and one of the biggest and longest lasting ones. But I didn't plan it. I'll tell you what was so great, though, about the last few years taking care of Margot is pushing daisies and Mike and Molly. For these things to come up, it was like, thank you, God. You know, wow. Because it's 4 minutes from my house. Mm. And to be that close to her when she really needed me and not have a play come up in New York that I absolutely had to do, I was so thankful because every play that came across my desk, I'd say, well, please don't let this be the one. Because, you know, if you read it and you go, I have to do this play, then you just work it out. I was relieved every time it wasn't the one and I could stay with her.
You mentioned Pushing Daisies, but what a wonderful character.
Oh, God. That show, I'm so proud to be. I feel like I was a little tiny part of a little tiny part of television history.
It was a jewel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We talked to Jim Dale recently about his participation in the program, and he was saying it was creating that perfection made it so expensive, which made it so difficult to produce on a regular basis. But it was so fascinating.
It was magical.
And you were wonderful at it.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a great character. And just to play on that, and Brian Fuller's mind, his playground, was extraordinary.
With all of that said, do you still keep an eye to the theater? Do you still look to New York and say?
For sure. Oh, yeah, for sure, because that's my dream, is to come back and do a play. But, you know, doing a play is a huge commitment. Everything is sacrificed on the altar of performance. Some people can manage to do all kinds of things while they're doing a play. I'm not one of them. I live like a nun. I eat like a nun. I sleep like, you know, when I'm in a play, it's that stamina for eight a week. You know, it's just, you just have to do it. It's not something where you can phone it in. It's got to be the first time, every time you do it, because that audience has never seen it before.
You are so adept at both comedy and drama.
Thank you.
Is that difficult for you or very natural?
It's very natural. I don't know how that happens, but it's a joy to me. And, you know, beyond my wildest dreams, this dream of mine has come true, to become other people. And to make someone laugh or make someone cry or move them in some way is the most thrilling experience. It's such a high. I mean, it's like a drug. Once you've had it, you have to have more of it. So that's, I think, with all of the awful side of this business and the sort of all the other side of it, you know, you live for those moments, which are just beyond thrilling. To make that connection with another human being, with an audience, and to feel something land, whether it's a laugh or a gasp, just this that connection is electric.
Susie Kurtz is the author of the new memoir, Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Thank you so much for spending time with us. What a delight.
Thank you, Joe, so much for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.